about dismissals. So we'll get started, and I'll say the same thing I just said on the record. Let's go ahead and go on the record. It's 1:31 in the afternoon of Wednesday, February 1st, 2012. We have a quorum here in the Judiciary Committee to conduct business. Senator Coghill is here, myself, Senator French, Senator Pascan, and Senator McGuire. I expect Senator Wilikowski shortly. We have three matters before the committee today. First will be continuation of SB 173, the revisor's bill. Then we will move to SB 165, which is a trusts bill. The record should reflect that Senator Wilikowski has joined us. And then finally, we'll have a short presentation, probably 15 minutes or so, from the court system on a follow-up matter from the Crime Summit court system and Department of Law, telling us about dismissals. We heard that there were a larger number of dismissals than I was aware of in felony cases, and I want to get some data about that. So without further, unless there's anything else coming for the committee, let's go ahead and start with SB 173. This is the revisor's bill, a shorter revisor's bill than has been in the past. The assistant revisor, Ms. Kurtz, is here in case there are further questions. But one thing I did not do last time was check and see whether anybody in the room or online would like to testify about 173, the revisor's bill. And seeing none, we're going to go ahead and close public testimony on that bill. That brings the bill back before us. Any committee discussion, questions, comments, concerns? With that, I would solicit a motion. Senator Wilikowski.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we move Senate Bill number 173 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection? And seeing none, the bill will move, and we'll take a short break for the paperwork. Let's have the committee come back to order. Next up is SB 165, dealing with trusts and estates, and it has a provision relating to the disposition of bodies. The CS before us is /D. If we could have a motion to put that before the committee.
So moved.
Is there objection? You can see none. The CS /D delta is before us, and we will turn now to a reading of the sponsor statement from my staffer, Cindy Smith. Ms. Smith, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Cindy Smith. I'm staff to Senator French. Alaska first modernized its trust and estate legislation in 1997. Since then, the trust and estate planning community continuously makes recommendations to the legislature for updates and improvements to Alaska's trust and estate laws and ensure that Alaska can continue to provide the best possible planning solutions. Alaska's trust and estate laws have significant impact on our economy, bringing literally millions of dollars to the state and creating jobs within the trust, banking, insurance, and legal fields. Senate Bill 165 provides for amendments to statute in the following areas. It extends protection for retirement plan assets to beneficiaries of retirement plans, often the surviving spouse. Provides means of representation for minors and incapacitated persons in dealing with settlement of accounts or settlement agreements. Amends the 2003 Alaska Principal and Income Act to conform with the current IRS regulations on that subject. Provides rules concerning who may control the disposition of a decedent's remains. And that's actually a new area of law for Alaska. There's nothing on the books right now. Makes conforming amendments to Alaska's laws regarding insurable interests to align the changes to the Uniform Trust Code. Provides that the IRA interests can be voluntarily transferred to a family member or to a trust. Makes amendments to Alaska's community property provisions to update and clarify the ownership of community property. Allows the beneficiary to extend the time frames that the funds will be held in a uniform transfer to minors account. Passage of the bill ensures that Alaska remains a premier state in which to establish trusts and estates, and I urge your support for the legislation. We have with us today Mr. Shaftel, who is one of the group of attorneys that works on the bill. And perhaps...
No, I don't see her yet.
Okay.
But will there also be, thank you, Ms. Smith, Beth Chapman, a local Juneau attorney, will be joining us to assist us in our deliberations on the bill. Let's turn, though, to Mr. Shaftel, who should be on the line. Mr. Shaftel, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Go ahead and put yourself on the record. We've asked you to assist us in walking through the sectional, so I'll go ahead and have you do that. Just make sure, and sometimes it's hard to get a question into someone who's testifying over the telephone, just make sure every couple of minutes or so you take a breath and just see if there's questions from the committee. You don't have to stop at every section because there's 37 of them, but just make sure every couple of pages you see if we're following there with you and or if we need to break in.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Shaftel. I'm an attorney. I'm in private practice in Anchorage. I work in the estate planning and trust and estate administration area. I'm a member of a group, an informal group of attorneys and trust officers and financial planners who have been working with the legislature since 1997 to suggest improvements in Alaska's trust and estate laws for the benefit of our residents. As a result, Alaska, the legislature has really been very dynamic in this area, has enacted a lot of very good provisions. We often lead the nation in various areas, and imitation, you know, is the highest form of flattery, and we seem to be imitated a lot, but we aren't bashful. We will imitate in our suggestions good ideas from other states in making suggestions to the legislature for matters that they might consider enacting. This is a changing area of the law. Nationwide, those of us who work in this area, we go to conferences and we hear about what's happening elsewhere. We sit in committees and discuss these subjects, and there must be 25 states nationwide that are constantly improving their laws in this area. So it is important for the residents of Alaska to be up to date on these matters so they have the best statutes in this area. Really, these laws affect everyone. I mean, there's no one who isn't affected by legislation, obviously, that affects estate planning, affects wills, affects the transfer of assets at death, also affects the ownership of financial assets during their lifetime. This bill, we think, is an excellent bill. It has a lot of just very kind of substantial bread and butter provisions in it that we need to improve for Alaska. Starting with Section 1 deals with inherited retirement plans, and in the federal area, the federal courts, the federal bankruptcy courts have been very active in this area, and the vast majority rule right now is that in the various bankruptcy courts in the states across the nation an inherited retirement plan, an IRA, is protected from that inheritor's creditors. To give you an example, husband contributes to an IRA during his lifetime and builds up a fund in there, and at age 70 and a half, of course, starts taking payments out. Husband dies, and he designates as the beneficiary of that plan his wife, his surviving spouse. Well, what this provision does is, under state law, it follows in federal law in the bankruptcy courts and says that those funds, that flow of funds that is going to be coming in over the wife's lifetime for her personal living expenses is going to be protected from her creditors. So that's Section 1 of the bill. Sections...
Mr. Schaftel, we have a question about the first section. Senator Pascan.
Yes, Mr. Schaftel, and does this mean that the IRA, it has to stay in that IRA form as compared to being transferred into a liquid account, so to speak?
Yes, it has to stay in the IRA, which is, of course, most advantageous for the surviving spouse, because then she can spread it over her lifetime, and while the funds stay in the IRA, they grow tax-free, income tax-free. Income tax is only paid when the funds are distributed out.
Senator Bassman.
And then secondarily, and again, this is an area that I'm glad there's people like you out there that, you know, because I don't practice in this area of law, but is there a limit on the amount of money that is exempted or protected under the federal bankruptcy law? So you have this fund that you keep it in the IRA, the corpus is protected, and then there's an income stream being generated from it. Is there a cap or maximum amount that can be protected that's coming out of that corpus?
In the federal bankruptcy area, for an IRA that you create and you contribute to over your lifetime, and then it's rolled over, the maximum amount that can be protected is $1 million. That's under the 2005 new Federal Bankruptcy Act.
And go ahead, Senator Pascan.
So the corpus itself is protected to the extent of $1 million, but again, I'm trying to focus on whatever income stream that comes out of there. Is there also a protection? In other words, if it's distributing $20,000 a month, for example, is that protected under this?
Once the funds come out, they are not protected. This protects the funds in the IRA. But once in any of these, once funds are distributed out, they're not protected.
Let me make sure I understand. And maybe Senator Pascan was about to ask, but I'll jump in. This is Hollis French, Mr. Schaftel. let's just use a $1 million IRA example. Let's say it's mine. I pass away. My wife inherits the $1 million. That $1 million in the account itself is protected against federal bankruptcy claims and if we pass this law, state bankruptcy claims. That's correct, right?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
But if she takes a withdrawal, let's say, just pick a number, if she withdraws $100,000 to pay her bills with, is that money now subject to creditors' claims?
At that point, a creditor could reach it, yes.
In both federal and state law?
That's correct.
I see. Well, that's very interesting. That's
it's
very
protected,
interesting.
So, it's so the creditor can't come in and grab that $1 million in our example fund. Let's say she had a $1 million creditor. Creditor couldn't come in and take all that $1 million and it would be gone. Now, these, you know, a typical IRA, distributions would be made over her lifetime, and so as those came out, a creditor could reach them, but in the meantime, she could reach an accommodation with that creditor settle it, or, you know, some judgments only last for a period of years.
Well, I'm just thankful to Senator Passman for sort of teasing out some of the nuances here. I understand it a lot better now. It's an interesting balancing act, I guess, between the creditor and the inheritor. Good explanation. Thank you.
So the next substantive provision is Section 4 of the bill, and this is a clarification. Under the Uniform Trust Code that we already have enacted, this section 1306.120 provides for what in the vernacular we call virtual representation. And basically what that means is that you can represent your minor children or your unborn children, and it's clear that you can do that in court. And that's really very important, because if there's a matter going on in court, let's say it's a trust accounting, that the court doesn't need to appoint a separate guardian ad litem to represent, who's really just another attorney, to represent the minor children or represent the unborn children. Now, this virtual representation, as long as you have the same interests as the person you're representing, then you will bind them. If you agree, let's say, to the accounting that's provided in a court proceeding, you're going to bind your minor children and your unborn children. They can't later on come back and attack it and reopen it. And as I say, that's a very practical purpose for that. Now, what's unclear from this statute, though, is does it apply to non-judicial settlement agreements? Because often we don't want to go into court. No sense in going into court and incurring all that extra expense and tying up the court system if we can reach a settlement, either a settlement of the accounting, which was the example I just gave, or, you know, it might be a dispute over an inheritance. And if everybody can get together and reach a settlement, that's fine. We want to clarify this statute to make sure that it applies in that setting to non-judicial settlements as well as judicial ones. And that's all this does. We think it's a very worthwhile clarification. Now, moving on to Sections 6 through Sections 22, these deal with the Uniform Principal and Income Act that we enacted in 2003 in Alaska. And this Uniform Act updated some prior Uniform Acts we had, but especially created some new provisions dealing with what are called unit trusts. And this deals with often trusts are created and they say, pay all the income out, just to give you an example, pay all the income out to my wife, and then pay, and then the principal of this trust, after my wife dies, will go on to my kids. So some tension is created between the wife's interests and the kids' interests. The wife wants all the assets to be invested in income-producing assets, like, let's say, bonds. The kids want the assets to be invested in other kinds of investments, like what used to be equities that used to produce growth. Hopefully they'll produce growth.
Is that back when the stock market used to go up?
Yeah. Right, that's right.
Oh, okay.
Hopefully that will come back.
I've heard of that. Right.
Well, it's kind of old history. It's getting farther back every day. But so there's this tension between what the trustee should do. And it's always been there, and it's created conflicts and created litigation. So the concept was developed, okay, look, bonds produce an average of, let's say, 3 to 5% return every year. So let's just say that every year the trustee will distribute out 3 to 5%, whatever we decide upon, to the surviving spouse. The trustee can invest all in equities, in stocks. Doesn't have to invest in bonds. If equities are really going up and that's the thing to invest in, can invest in that and then every year sells 5% of those, distributes them out as income to the surviving spouse. And then we don't have this conflict anymore. And so also, when this new approach was adopted, they said we have to have a method for converting all of these existing trusts that say income to spouse and remainder to kids to saying unit trust payment to spouse and then remainder to kids. And so there's a way to convert that that's set out in this act. And this, as I said, was the Alaska legislature initially enacted this in 2003, but then as it over the past, 8 years or so, the people who monitor this closely have recommended changes to update the act, and we've been consulting with an expert back in Pittsburgh whose passion really is to follow this in the various states and to recommend changes. And so he recommended these changes to us, and he actually helped us draft all these changes. And they're before you. What they do, among other things, is they create a little bit more flexibility. Our initial statute said that unit trust amount has to be 4%, although you could go to court and get a court to change it. Remember, we're trying to keep a balance between the surviving spouse and the kids and their different interests. What the recommendation is, well, let's give a little more flexibility to the trustee. The trustee can choose between 3 and 5%. And then again, we're saying, okay, let's say we choose 5%. 5% of what? Is it the assets this year that the trust has? And the concept here, look, it really would be better to average the amount of assets this trust has had over a period of time so we get a smoothing effect on this flow of unit trust payments to the surviving spouse. So here it allows the trustee to choose between 3 to 5 years for this smoothing effect, this averaging effect. Then there was a little bit of clarification needed as to when distributions are made, we want to have an ordering of them when they come out of the trust in terms of are they capital gain, are they ordinary income, are they a return to principal. And so the new act, the amendments provide an ordering provision that's guidance for compliance work. Further, if the trustee who makes this decision, you don't want, if one of the children is named as a trustee or the wife is named as a trustee, you don't want that person making this decision and making these choices because obviously they have an interest in having them go in a certain direction. So it provides that if you have a disqualified trustee, in other words, somebody who's a beneficiary, that you can appoint an independent trustee. It also provides that retirement trusts can use the same kind of unit trust concept. So these are really quite non-controversial and very excellent upgrades to the Alaska's Uniform Principal and Income Act.
Let's stop here and take a couple questions. We'll start with Senator Pascan.
Sure. Under the disqualified trustee issue that you raised, are there standards in law, fiduciary standards in law, that trustee must abide by?
Yes. I mean, that's a very good point. And the trustee is held to a very high fiduciary standard. And if there's an abuse of discretion, that trustee can be surcharged. In other words, if there are damages that result from this, from a, let's say, a biased abuse of discretion, that the parties that are injured can go to court, and the trustee not only will be lose his position, but he'll also be held liable.
And then just as a follow-up, are there disclosure requirements as to any potential conflicts of interest? In other words, I understand the process where if somebody catches somebody after the event and you can hold them responsible under that fiduciary standard, but are there upfront disclosure standards saying, you know I am not supposed to be doing this, 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 and this, or so? Is there something like that, meaning a proactive protection of whatever other interests there might be?
Well, I can tell you what I think good, solid practitioners do in this area, and our office does, and a number of the estate planning attorneys that, who have been practicing for a period of time in Alaska belong to the American College of Trust and Estate Counsel. And what we do is we give a pamphlet to trustees when they're appointed, and they have to sign for it and sign that they have read it, that tells them all of their duties and their responsibilities, and their duties of loyalty and their duties of trust. So they are made aware of that up front. Unlike the legislature, though, I'm not familiar in this area of requirements where, for example, if you were voting on a bill and you had a financial interest in that subject matter, I know you'd disclose it, or maybe even be recused. But that same kind of technique isn't as easily applicable in the trustee area.
Question now, and thank you, Senator Pascoe. Maybe just back up and remind me of the difference between a trust and a unit trust.
The unit trust is merely a term for this annual payment that is made that is based upon a percentage of the principal, the assets in the trust.
So it's
the trust
just
itself is a much broader vehicle. So let's say that you create a trust for your wife and the remainder to your kids, and you put $500,000 into it. Well, the trust concept is that you name a trustee. Let's say you name a bank as the trustee of that trust. So that trust has certain assets. Those assets are owned by the trustee, the bank. The bank must administer that trust according to the directions in the trust instrument for the benefit of the beneficiaries, who are your wife and your children. That's what a trust is. The unit trust amount, that is referring to the fact that you may have set up this trust and said, I want paid out to my wife every year an amount that's equal to 5% of the assets in that trust. That concept in itself is called the unit trust.
So it's simply just a designation of the payout mechanism and percentage.
That's right.
Okay.
Then
let's turn to Section 11, because there we've added a new section establishing a range of payout percentages rather than the 4% we have now. It's essentially saying you can choose between 3 and 5, still a fairly narrow band of payouts. Are these percentages something we're going to have to adjust in the future? May they have to go down? I mean, just imagine that we get, you know, another 5 years of flat stock market performance. Would we have to drive this lower percentage down even further to 2% or so to maintain the strength of a trust buying power over time?
Perhaps. Keep in mind that there are provisions in the Act to go to court and get a different percentage. This percentage that we're talking about, the 3 to 5% right now, is saying, what the legislature is saying is, we think that is fair. It's a fair balance between the interests of the person who's getting the unit trust payment, in our example, the spouse, and the remainder persons, the children, who will get the remainder after the spouse dies. And so what you're saying when you enact this is, we think that's a fair balance right now. Now, there are a couple ways that could be changed. You put your finger on one of them, and that is the legislature could change this in the future if they see economics going in a different direction. The other way, though, is in the Act, and it says that If it turned out that it would be, that the trustee thinks it would be fairer to pay out 2% or 6%, the trustee can go into court and ask the court's permission. And when you go into court, of course, you always notice up everyone. And everybody has a right to participate. In other words, the wife would have a right to participate in our example, and so would the children.
I see that's in Section 14. The court process.
And we don't have the full act, of course, in the bill. Only the provisions were changing.
Sure, sure. Okay, thank you. Those are my questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill has a question. One second, Mr. Shaftel. Hold on. Go ahead.
Well, this brought up a question that I had in another section, and that was dealing with IRAs. What would be the tax consideration of this particular flexibility?
And excuse me, is that Senator
Coghill? That's Coghill, yep.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Coghill? Which section of the bill were you referring to?
The one under the between 3 to 5%.
The unit trust.
Would that become a major consideration is what I'm looking for on doing that? Because if you're looking for a balance, I was just wondering how that might tilt the balance on what the tax consideration of a payout would be.
Well, through the chair, that's a relevant question. The trustee has to take that into consideration as well. The way trust income taxation works is that depending on the kind of trust you have, but this kind of trust, when a distribution comes out, it carries with it ordinary income to the extent there is ordinary income earned by the trust. So if a 5% distribution came out and that trust had made more than 5% income that year, it first takes out all that income. So that would all be taxable to the spouse at that point. That is not a change that would be any different than in the prior kind of structure that was used, a trust that just says all income gets paid out to the spouse every year. That's the case. That spouse is getting, she's getting the income, let's say it's $20,000, but if that trust had earned $20,000 of income that year, she's also getting taxability on that full $20,000.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just kind of curious how that, if that flexibility just entered into a greater decision. If we set that tax, that whole percentage rate, it probably wouldn't diminish it, but it just now enters in, you got a choice as consideration. So.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Mr. Shaftel, I think we're ready to go on to the next section.
Mr. Chairman, then we're in sections 23 through 25, and this area was brought up actually through conferences with parents who have had concerns about their child's ability to manage funds. There are accounts. They're called Uniform Transfer to Minor Accounts. And Alaska has adopted this statute for these kinds of accounts, as have almost every other state in the union. What these accounts generally are used for is the parents can gift up to $13,000 per year for their child, and they can gift it to these accounts gift tax free, and then when the child, they can use the money in the account or the custodian of the account, which may be the parent, but it may also be someone other than the parent, and use the funds for the benefit of the minor. And then when the minor reaches the age of 18 or 21 years, depending on the type of transfer that was made into the account, the funds become the minor's funds. And we have been made aware, and this is not just an Alaska phenomenon, but nationwide, we hear it discussed, of situations where relatively large amounts of money, you know, $200,000-$300,000, or maybe sometimes a really a good investment was made and it's more than that, is in one of these accounts for a minor child, and the child reaches the age of 18 years old and really is not mature enough to manage money like that. The money might, the child may have a disability, may have a, some type of chemical problem, may just be someone who, if you gave him or her that amount of money, it would really derail them from growing, from going to school, from kind of learning how to be a responsible adult, and they might go off for a period of time just using those funds to do something that really did, their family felt wouldn't really contribute to their maturity. So it was suggested that we come up with a provision that both would be consistent with the Internal Revenue Code provision, which allows this to be gift tax free when it goes in. And what that provision basically says is that for it to be gift tax free, when the minor reaches age 18, you have to say to the minor, it's yours if you want it. But this gives us some flexibility where the parent can go to the minor and say, look, you know, you have this account, but I think it would be better for you, and discuss it with the minor, if we kept it in this account, managed for you by the custodian of that account to a different age. In the past, this was allowed, but only up to age 25. What this provision does is it allows that age to go beyond age 25. So in any of the scenarios that I've tried to describe, the parent could go to the minor and discuss it, and if the minor was agreeable, then it could be held in the account to age 40. It might be in some situations that people would really always want somebody else managing the account for them, or maybe it would be just enough to, you know, the parent to go and reason with the child and say, how about we hold this into age 30 or 35, which would make everybody more comfortable with the minor's maturity and have been given a chance to kind of establish themselves on their own without being the influence of this very large amount of funds. So that's what this is all about. It is, we've consulted with attorneys nationwide, really, to get different views on this, to see if this would be a problem. Nobody thinks it would be a problem. As far as the Internal Revenue Code goes, we'll still have this benefit of allowing everyone to use these accounts for gift tax-free giving. But we'll also have this flexibility to extend the time of distribution if the minor agrees.
Thank you, Mr. Schaftel. And Senator McGuire has a question.
Thank you, and through the chair, hi, Dave, how are you? Good to see you.
Hello, Senator McGuire.
Rather hear you on the other end. Great bill and support. I just have a couple questions in this area and then the next one in Section 26. But my first question is, when we make the move to comply with the outright tax-free provision at the uniform level, I think that's great. Do we have to delete the reference in our existing statute to 25 years of age? I noticed that it's deleted in two of the sections, and I worry about that because up to this point there has been discretion under the statute in certain circumstances to allow for delayed distribution up to 25, and I worry that in removing that we're going to eliminate that option.
What is intended, through the chair, Senator McGuire, what is intended is to still allow that same flexibility to choose age 25, but really to choose any age. So, for example, if you wanted it to be age 25, again, even under the existing statute, you do have to get the child's agreement. If you want it to be a later age, though, you can suggest that age as well. So it's the way we drafted it, the intention was to give full flexibility there.
Senator McGuire has a follow-up.
Thank you. Yeah, and I've got a few questions in here, if I might, Mr. Chairman. So what in your sponsor statement, in the sponsor statement from Senator French here, it states that the statute allows the age of distribution to be extended in certain circumstances to age 25. And it also talks about the fact that under current statute, that it may be that the distribution is at age 21 as well. So what I want to be clear about in moving to this new statute, which I support and understand the intent, that it's to make it clear that it's tax-free and that you're going to ask the child if you believe that, you know, they're not ready to manage their fund for the ability to extend it. Okay, but let's be honest. Some 18-year-olds are not reasonable. Let's just assume that that's true. And so what I liked about the current provision is that it seemed to allow for that extension up to 25 in certain circumstances, which was just a few more years of maturity. And so what I want to be sure that we're not doing is eliminating that ability, never mind this option to sit down and reason with the 18-year-old and ask them kindly to extend the distribution out. I don't want to eliminate that ability to have a payout at 25. And I'm worried we are by deleting the reference to that in two specific places in Section 23 and 25.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, my memory of this provision is in that language in certain circumstances. Those circumstances that were referred to there were the circumstances of going to the child and asking for the child's consent. That's what was meant by in certain circumstances.
Okay, well, if you could get back to me on that, I'd like to know what the certain circumstances were, why the year 21 years of age was referenced, and what I'm referring to is page 2 of the summary, and why 25 was referenced. I just want to be sure that we're not giving up an opportunity here to have a bit more discretion in that payout. And if the answer is we've got to give it up in order to have the absolute certainty that it will be tax-free, then fine. I want to have that discussion, but I'd like to know for sure that we're not giving anything up. And if I might, my second final question is, how long of an extension, and what is the recourse for a child that reaches the age of maturity who gives the agreement that they would like to have their money managed longer, let's say at 18. So I'm thinking of, let's use Grayson. So I put money into a tax-free trust for Grayson, and at 18 I'm able to rationalize with him because he's different than Senator French's son at 18, right, and all the other sons I know. And he says, oh, mother, yes, I think you're wise beyond your years. And, you know, if you're telling me this is the right thing to do, then obviously I would like you to keep managing my money because I don't want to spend it on Corvettes and girls. What I'd like to do is have it managed well. Let's say he says that. How long then, let's say I say, well, then I'd like it for another 40 years. But Master Grayson decides that he's mature at 25, and maybe he is, and would like to go into medical school. What recourse, if any, does he have to come back to the trustee and say, you know, I feel as if I've extended 40 years out unwittingly. I mean, I really do feel like I'm mature now. And at 18, I gave my consent for an extension that really is beyond what I meant to do at that time.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, there are a couple of aspects to that. One of them is that this account is very much like a trust. There is a custodian named, and in your example, you are the custodian. But the money is really your son's, Grayson's. And you have an obligation. You cannot be arbitrary. You are like a trustee as that custodian. you can't abuse your discretion. So if Grayson has needs, and in your example, those were college tuition and expenses, and you refuse to, I mean, well, the first thing is I know you wouldn't refuse to,
right.
But you have the power. In other words, and the statute encourages you to use the funds for Grayson's needs that aren't otherwise provided for. If you were to refuse to do that, if you just said, well, you know, I just think I've got these great investments here and I'm having fun investing the money and you figure out your own way of going to college, that's an abuse of discretion.
Okay.
And you could be replaced as custodian.
And if I might last point through the chair is that, you know, what I meant to do is even say that, let's say I passed away and left somebody else as the custodian and who didn't have that same viewpoint. And so that's a great reminder that this is set up and subject then to all of those same protections and requirements that exist already, which is the abuse of discretion and that you're managing it for the benefit of the trustee.
Through the chair, yes, that's absolutely right, Senator McGuire. And your other requests for information, I will get back to you on those by tomorrow.
Great, thank you.
Senator Pasquin has a question.
Just as a follow-up to some of those questions, as I understand, the longer the trustor would want to have the tail control, is it more likely that the beneficiary would not consent to that extension? In other words, if the minor says, I'm 18 years old and I'm either consenting that I don't get this until I'm 50, then they're going to say, you know, I want it all now because I don't want to risk not having the opportunity when I'm married, who knows if, you know, any of those things. In other words, does that promote the lack of consent the longer the tail control exists? And that brings up, I guess, the second question is that if the minor consents at age 21 and they consent to a 20-year extension of that trust, do they get times later, like 5 years later, 10 years later, where they have a secondary option?
Through the chair, Senator Passman. Those are good points, and I think you're absolutely right in the negotiation that's going to go on. And what the law is presuming, and does presume in the state of Alaska, is that when somebody reaches the age of 18, they are an adult. They can make decisions. They can enter into contracts. They can be bound. They're responsible for their actions. So that, as we all know, isn't always the case. But that isn't always the case with people who are 50 years old either.
That's right.
But that certainly, that person who has now reached the age of 18 will very likely be resistant if it's just a matter of maturity and experience, that I would think they'd be very resistant to a long-term extension. And would be much more likely to consent to a shorter one. Further, I would think the practical way to do it would be if they agreed to an extension, let's say, to age 30, and then at age 30, if there still were reasons for a further extension, it could be extended again. The other way around, though, it isn't set up that way. In other words, if they agreed to a 20-year extension at age 21, and then at age, let's say, 30, for one reason or another, felt like at that point they really wanted, you know, they were capable, the reasons that no longer existed. I think that certainly we could go to court and get the probate court, assuming that no one objected to that, we could get it terminated at that point. If there were objections, let's say, from the custodian, the custodian would have to justify it. If there was no justification for it, I would think at that point the child would have a good argument for getting the probate court to say, well, this was extended to age 40, but there's no longer any reason for it. I don't find any merit in the reasons suggested by the custodian, I'm going to terminate it.
Paula.
Does that address your question?
Yes, we're getting nods. I have one more question on this area, then we'll have to move on, and we may have to come back to it. But on page 15, section 25, sub I, regarding the power of a minor to compel distribution, it says that minor can do so provided the he or she gives notice during the six-month period that begins on the date that's the later of the minor's 18th birthday, or the age for distribution specified in the transfer document or specified otherwise by this chapter. Give me again, if you would, the range of ages that could be could comply with that sub number one, the age of distribution specified in the transfer document or specified otherwise by this chapter. What's the range there?
Mr. Chairman, for certain types of transfers, I have to go back and refresh myself. There's a lifetime transfer into one of these accounts. One of the ages applies, like age 18. If it's a, I think maybe that's age 21. If it's a transfer at death, I think it's age 18 or age 21. So depending on the type of transfer that's made, you can tie it up initially until 18 or 21. Further, the statute provides that if age 21 or 18, you go to the minor and the minor agrees, then you can extend it to age 25.
Very
those
good.
Are the
but ages. It sounds like even under the minor's first of all, let's take the case of the minor that doesn't consent, who's just adamant. Nope, I'm ready to have the money. You're saying it's probably the upper limit on there is 21 or maybe 25.
21 unless the minor has consented previously.
Okay. I'll just leave it as a follow-up to just double-check on that. Maybe shoot me an email to that effect, and I'll distribute it amongst the committee members. That to me, just seems like a very sort of nice circuit breaker for the minor.
Yes.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and move on then.
Okay. The next section we're coming to is the decedent's remains in section 26. And this is an area that was brought to our attention by presentations made by directors of funeral homes who basically said, you know, they don't have any guidance at all as to who to take directions from in terms of disposition of human remains. And it can have all kinds of consequences as to where the remains go, whether they're going to be cremated, whether they're going to be buried, what type of memorial is going to occur. So they were very uncomfortable with this, and we looked around, and we had a subcommittee who looked at statutes in other areas. And the result has been this provision, which was introduced as a bill in the legislature several years ago, but wasn't enacted then just because didn't get to it. But what this provision does is it provides for directions to be made in a disposition document, and it provides priorities of persons who will have the authority to direct for the disposition of the remains. It provides for a form, a document, that what will happen is that if you enact this provision, I mean, all estate planning attorneys will then be using this form for their clients. So it will be one of the documents that people will sign when they're doing their planning to give these directions as to who would have this authority. It also has some technical areas. For example, if people put directions in a will, as to what they want to have happen to their remains. That will does not have to be probated, because, of course, that could take a considerable period of time for those directions to be respected and to be effective. And it also has a liability provision that says that if funeral homes basically follow this statute, that they won't be held liable, which was a real concern. I mean, you hear very unfortunate stories about delays, very substantial delays that occur because everybody's kind of frozen in their tracks, not knowing what to do and who to follow, and they're getting different directions from different people. So that's Section 26. Section 27.
Well, one second, and I'll just say I know that we've handled a very problematic situation through our office trying to help a constituent with just this matter of getting a body released. It's, you know, as traumatic as you can imagine, as emotional as you can imagine, and so I'm glad to see we're addressing it. Senator Passman has a question.
In your discussion with the funeral home operators, what, if anything, have they raised as far as the issue of same-sex domestic partners?
I'm not sure that that was expressed directly, but with this list of priorities that this form allows, that would allow a person to name someone, you know, a domestic partner, who would have the authority to give these directions. So that problem would be resolved in that fashion.
That's through the that's through the on page 16. I think it's page 16, line 13 and 14. That's just designated in that disposition document.
Yes.
It can be as long as it's done in advance.
Which is one of the benefits of this approach, is that it allows a person to make their own determination as to who they want to have the authority to give directions concerning the disposition of their remains.
Thank you. Don't see any further questions. Let's move on.
Okay. Section 27 deals with a problem that was developed, really stemmed out of a 2005 case in the Eastern District of Virginia called Chawla, and it dealt with insurable interests. And basically the issue was, if you decide that you want to buy an insurance policy and you want that insurance policy owned by a trust for the benefit of your family, The issue is, can that trustee legally own that insurance, or can the trustee legally go out and buy a policy on your life? Does the trustee have what's called an insurable interest? And the concept of an insurable interest in the law generally is that I can't go out, for example, and buy an insurance policy on Chairman French. I'm not part of his family. I don't have any interest that really should allow me to buy insurance on his life and benefit by his death. But I do have an interest in buying insurance on my wife's life, and my kids have insurance and an interest in buying insurance on my life because they're dependent somewhat financially on me. And so there is this concept in the law of insurable interests, and most states have a statute, but the statutes in many states were really unclear, and that's what happened back in Virginia, and they challenged whether the insurance company went in and said, basically, we don't have to pay because you never had an insurable interest. And that, of course, is a very bad result. So the Uniform Trust Code, the commissioners who draft these uniform statutes had come up with language to cure this problem. And this provision that's suggested here is following the Uniform Trust Code provisions for the most part. And it's to solve this problem created by the Chawla case.
Don't see any questions. Let's keep moving. Thank you.
In Section 28 of the bill, this deals with transfers of IRA interests. This provision would allow you to take your IRA interest and place it into a trust. It would be, in the tax law, there's the type of trust that's called a grantor trust. And what that means is there are no negative income tax consequences between you and that trust. You can put assets in, take assets out, exchange assets, and it's not a taxable event for income tax purposes. But that trust, assets in that trust, when you transfer assets into it, it's a gift under the gift tax. You would account for it under the gift tax, but then the growth of those assets and their growth are not included in your gross estate and taxed at death. And so this provision, the ownership of an IRA, an individual retirement account, is a matter of state law. And it's unclear from our statutes right now whether an IRA interest could be transferred under state law, because it is what's called a type of spendthrift trust. And so this provision would allow it to be transferred, and it's primarily the reason is, as I described, it's for tax planning benefits, for estate tax minimization benefits, and it would be allow flexibility and allow some more creative estate tax planning for residents of Alaska.
And just briefly, how many jurisdictions have adopted this rule?
This is not one that we found in other jurisdictions. This is one that was suggested to us as something that would be beneficial. And since it is a matter of state law, you would want to be careful in doing it, because it's just like you'd want to be careful in taking a distribution out of your IRA. If you take a distribution out of your IRA and you are less than age 55, there's a penalty. And also, on top of that, when you take distributions out, if it's a traditional IRA, there's income tax payable. So you always have to be careful when you are dealing with your IRA, and you have to follow the rules. And this would be one as well. You'd have to be careful. You would want to go to your tax advisor and see if this would be good planning or not. But it does allow for, as I've described, the transfer of an IRA interest into a grantor trust, which could help minimize estate taxes at death.
Thank you.
The last four sections, 29 through 33, deal with Alaska's optional community property system. And that was enacted in 1998. And over the years, we have we've had experience in implementing it, and we've seen the need to clarify certain areas. Let me give you some examples. Community property is a very unusual type of property system. As you know, it's between husband and wife. They both of them equally own the property. They have equal undivided interest in all the property. It's a system enacted in 10 states, and it's often considered the fairest, most equitable system of ownership of assets during marriage. It generally applies to assets acquired during marriage. In Alaska, we can opt into a community property system, and you can choose which assets you want to be community property. But one thing about community property is that Well, let me back up. To opt into it, you do it through a community property agreement. The two spouses enter into a written agreement, or they can create a trust, often called a joint revocable trust, and they place assets into that trust, and they label those assets when they go in on the schedule as community property. One of the problems that's developed is often that will occur, but they won't change title to the asset. It'll be listed on the schedule in the agreement or in the trust, but they'll fail to change title. And what's unusual about community property is even if you were in one of the other community property states, the actual form of title is not determinative of who owns the property, so it might own. The title may say this piece of property is owned just by the husband. But if it's community property, both husband and wife have an equal interest in it. It doesn't matter about the form of title. And we wanted to clarify that in Alaska so that title companies and banks and other institutions would understand, and we wouldn't have to go to court to get this clarified, that if the spouses decided they wanted a certain, whether it's an account or whether it's a parcel of real property or an interest in a business, if they decided it was going to be community property, the form of title is not determinative. Rather, it's their determination that it was community property. Another problem that developed is that if property is owned in a form of survivorship, then the question is, and let me give you an example. In this situation, let's say that you own your house as a tenants by the entirety. Well, that gives a right of survivorship in the surviving spouse. And what the statute says is if that's the case and it's labeled community property, the fact that it's labeled community property does not change the survivorship provision. It continues to apply. We're going to presume that. There's another provision here that where we're seeing problems in the past that we wanted to clarify, and that's if you have community property. Let's say you have an investment account that has $500,000 in it, and that investment account allows for a beneficiary designation. And the husband designates a charity, let's say, to receive the property at his death. Well, if the wife didn't participate in that, then the question is, can this occur? Can the husband override her half ownership? And the answer is no. Each spouse has to agree to that. There's a certain presumptions for example, if the beneficiary was the surviving spouse or the children. But those presumptions can be overridden by one spouse's testimony. In other words, the surviving spouse could come in and say, you know, I know there's a presumption that this is supposed to go this way, but I don't agree to it. And so she can get her half of the community property back. There are also provisions in here about remedies. When one spouse does something with community property, which, again, is owned by both spouses, and when one spouse is trying to dispose of it without the other spouse's consent, there are remedies and limitation periods for when the other spouse can come in, object to it, and have the remedy of receiving back his or her half interest. But there are time limits on that, which, like any other time limits, for example, after death, there's a claim period. There's a policy in the law that you want estates wound up within a certain period of time. So the other spouse has that same claim period to come in and say, whoops, no, that property was community property. It can't go off in that direction. Half of it needs to come back to me. So these are all very helpful provisions for our community property law and just clarifying areas that where we've found where there were kind of gray areas that needed some specific rules after we've had experience with this law for now almost 14 years.
Mr. Schaftel, thank you. We have time for one more question from Senator Paskin, and then we'll have to turn to another matter that we're going to address before we gavel out today. So, Senator Pasavan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the property that the surviving spouse can claim an interest in, is that only property that's classified with a right of survivorship, or is that any property acquired during the term of the marriage?
Through the chair, it would be any. It wouldn't be just limited to survivorship property. That was just one area of concern, that survivorship area. But it could be, let's say, an account that was owned as community property. Again, let's go back to that $500,000 account. It's just in the husband's name, but the two spouses together have entered into a community property agreement saying it's community property. And the husband decides to make gifts of it to, you know, his children from a former marriage. And he's doing that during his lifetime. He's just taking big hunks of it, $100,000 at a time, and making gifts of it. The wife can come in and say, wait a minute, half that's mine. You can't do that, and get it, and she can get her half back.
Thank you, Mr. Schaftel. We have one more question about the repealers in Section 34. I'm going to actually have to push that over to the next meeting. We'll just make sure we address it very carefully. I appreciate that because repealers are extremely important. But I have asked other witnesses to come in on another matter. We do have one person who's been on the line, Doug Blockmacher. I don't want to overlook him. Mr. Blockmacher, if you're there, we'll go ahead and hear your views on this bill, as long as you can keep them to about 2 minutes.
Thank you, Senator. I'm Douglas Blockmacher from Alaska Trust Company, and we support this bill. We think it brings a lot of clarification and some good provisions that Alaskans can use, and we encourage the committee to approve it.
That was way under 2 minutes. That was fantastic, and I appreciate that. We'll keep those comments in mind. We'll have Mr. Schaftel back to finish explaining the repealers and the last couple of indirect rule changes, as well as give the committee some time to chew on this rather weighty matter, and that way we can jump back in with other questions. So with that, we're going to go ahead and set the bill aside for the time being. Thank you, gentlemen. Let's turn now to the matter that we're going to take up, which is just a little sort of follow-through on a crime summit issue that came up regarding case dismissals. We have both Nancy Mead and John Skidmore here, one from the court system, one from the Department of Law. Why don't you both come forward, and that way we can have a less of a formal dialogue and more of a conversation about this. It's not meant to be an inquisition. It's just a matter of a personal interest to me. I think it'll be of interest to the committee and to the community at large. Thank you for both being here. Put yourselves on the record. And then to make life easier for the records, when you speak, just say this is Ms. Mead or Nancy, or this is Mr. Skidmore or John, whichever you want to use. But just down the road, when people transcribe these, it's just 10 times easier. Thank you. So go ahead and introduce yourselves.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This is Nancy Mead of the Alaska Court System, and I can answer questions or I can try to summarize for you some of the documents that I distributed ahead of time.
Why don't you go ahead and do that, and then go ahead and summarize them, and then we'll get Mr. Skidmore's perspective on some of the questions that will come his way. Thank you.
Okay, great. As I understand it, there's kind of two separate issues that I could help explain today. One is directly a follow-up from the Crime Summit, and that is where I brought up the statistic that 23.5% of our felony cases in FY11 were dismissed, and I think that was surprising to some of the members of the committee, so I'm prepared to talk about that. A second separate, I suppose not entirely unrelated issue, is the time it is taking for felonies to be disposed of. I do see those as separate, tell you why when we get there. But the first one, the dismissal rate for felonies, might be easiest if we all look at the same piece of paper. All the charts are the same. There's six pieces of paper that are not landscape sideways charts, but the vertical charts with the big square box in the middle.
Let me make sure I'm on the right page then. They're not, if they are numbered, they're numbered. Well, actually, yeah. They all have number one on them. So
I have three fiscal years and three calendar years.
Ah, very good. Okay,
and
so
then 11, 10, 9 okay. within each of those. So if we look at fiscal year 2011, just okay. so we're all on the same page,
okay.
And Mr. Skidmore from the Department of Law and I have talked about these briefly and exchanged these documents.
It's recent data. It's so go ahead.
Okay. So this would address directly that 23.5% percent felony dismissal rate, which you can see under case disposition along the top, what percentage of our cases that were dismissed in that year were acquittals, the 0.5, what percentage were convictions, and then the percentage of dismissals, 23.4%. That's where the number came from with the crime summit. Below that in the box is a breakdown of all those, the 1,452 dismissed cases, why they were dismissed, what categories our case management system, CourtView, put those in. And you can see within that box the type of dismissal that's most common is right about there in the middle, the big number, 1,065, 73.3% of those dismissed were dismissed by the prosecution under Criminal Rule 43A. And again, Mr. Skidmore can address the reasons. Our statistics don't give reasons a prosecutor might give that, but these are the numbers that we have.
Great, and we have a question from Senator Paskin.
Yes.
Does convictions mean felony conviction or any conviction?
Felony conviction.
Okay.
Okay.
And
Go ahead. I'm sorry, through the chair. The way we categorize our cases is by the most serious charge within a charging document. So very often, as you know, there might be one felony and three misdemeanors. If somebody pleads to just three misdemeanors, it's a district court case if they do that very early on before the case's jurisdiction transfers to superior court, which I know is probably confusing. Mm-hmm. But almost all criminal cases are initiated in the district court, which doesn't have jurisdiction to dispose of a felony. But many things then happen right away, and they can be disposed of early, before jurisdiction transfers, pre-indictment.
And let me ask maybe a related question. Let's just imagine that a person's charged with three crimes, vehicle theft, possession of marijuana, possession of cocaine. You know, a guy busted in a stolen car and he gets these three charges. And let's say he just pleads to the vehicle theft and the drug charges go away, as it were. That shows up as a conviction. And that's a yes. And that's fine. And it would not show up as a dismissal. That is, the fact that a couple charges go away isn't going to count as a dismissal. Is that right?
You are correct.
Okay, so it's a case-wide sort of perspective.
That's exactly right. And again, I think you'll hear a little more about that from the Department of Law. It is cases. Cases have many charges.
Sure.
But sometimes if there are several incidents, in January he stole a car, in February he assaulted someone, there can be, of course, many cases for one defendant.
Sure, but as long as it comes under one charging document, that's one case, and that's gonna get resolved as such.
That's correct, Mr.
Let's turn to Mr. Skidmore. Please put yourself on the record and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is John Skidmore. I'm the director of the Criminal Division for the Department of Law. It's a pleasure to be here in front of the committee. It's nice to see you, Chairman French, and nice to see you all again as well.
Likewise.
So,
Go ahead.
I can answer questions, or I can give you sort of a spiel on how I think the numbers are a little different when we look at them versus when the court system does. I'll leave it to you how you want me to proceed.
Well, let's first sort of get to bedrock, and then we can go to maybe a more nuanced look at the situation. You certainly have a greater sort of perspective on the day-to-day details than we do, but I guess I'll just say, you know, a number that jumps out at me, and I'm going back to this landscape document, the first one, and that you can see the one I've circled, which is these are dismissals of Superior Court felonies.
I'm sorry, are you looking at the time to disposition, sir?
Yeah, time to disposition, It gives me a perspective on when cases are dismissed.
Sure.
And I'm seeing that between the time frame of 191 days to 365 days, 6 months to a year, of the dismissals, 28% of them are dismissed between 6 months and a year after they've been filed. And so maybe you can give the committee and me some reason why it would take so long to come to a place where you're saying, I give up. I mean, it's essentially, you know, the prosecution saying we can't go forward for a variety of reasons.
I can answer that in two words: plea negotiations.
Okay.
What that means for folks is that what happens frequently in the criminal justice system is we have individuals that will get charged with a crime and then get released on bail. They pick up another crime or another case while they're out on bail. And then when it's time for us to resolve the cases, we will resolve them by having them plead to one and dismiss the other one. What we generally do in plea negotiations is if we had but the single case, take Chairman French's example, where someone is charged with a vehicle theft, a drug offense, and I forget the third crime.
There were two drug offenses.
Two drug
offenses. Marijuana and cocaine. Right.
And so in that case, if we were originally going to, and I'm going to throw a number out, don't put any meaning to this number other than to help illustrate. Let's say that we wanted them to serve a year in jail as the result of the crimes that they had committed in that case, and that would be the original offer. That person gets out on bail. They go out and commit another crime. It's, again, a vehicle theft, more drug offenses, what have you. What we can do is we can still resolve those cases. The plea deal in the first case, instead of doing a year, now maybe a year and a half, maybe it's 2 years, but we agree to dismiss the second case. And that is what I believe accounts for a large percentage of those dismissals. I can't tell you that it accounts for all of them because that certainly wouldn't be accurate. There are other situations in which you can have a case where the prosecution will learn more details as you get further on into it. Just because the police have referred an investigation to us initially does not mean that that's when the investigation has stopped. You will notice on the chart that there are some cases that remain open and active for, you know, 1 to 2 years, some of them for longer than 2 years. I myself have personally prosecuted cases that have been going on for 5 years or longer. And there's all sorts of reasons I can give you behind that if you were interested, but the point being is that throughout that entire time, the investigation continues. And when the investigation continues, sometimes it means that the case gets better. And that is stronger, and we're more likely to get a conviction. There are other times in which we will learn new and additional information that we didn't have before, but now that we're in possession of it, we say to ourselves, that case is not nearly as strong as it was before. That creates problems. We may try and resolve that through a plea negotiation, or it may simply be that we say, you know what, with this new additional information, the right thing to do is to dismiss that case. I apologize, I can't tell you what the percentages are for those. Our case management system doesn't allow me to do those sorts of things. I could tell you that in 2011, we filed 70,000 counts, not cases, counts. I can tell you of those 70,000 counts, we dismissed 14,000. Now, A lot of those can be in the same case. But I can tell you that when I looked at those numbers, over half of them were dismissed because of plea negotiations and the person pled to something else. In other words, I can break dismissals down into three large categories and give you some other ideas about it. I break them down into the areas of what I call evidentiary reasons. Evidentiary reasons are things like the mens rea, the mental element necessary to commit a crime. There's insufficient evidence to prove that. It can be things like the value of the property that's damaged or stolen, the age of the defendant or the victim, some other essential element, inadequate identification, inadequate corroboration, physical evidence that's no longer available to us, some issue with a witness. They're unavailable, we've deemed them to be not credible, they're uncooperative, or we can't locate them. Sometimes we'll have somebody and 2 years later comes time to go to trial, and though we've been trying to stay in touch with them, we've lost touch with them. The case comes up for trial, we can't get them in there. We have to dismiss the case in those circumstances. We don't like to, and that's not very frequent that that happens, but that can occur. So that's one category of why cases can be dismissed. Within that category as well would be there was a problem with searching for evidence, a statement is suppressed, an identification is suppressed. That is, there's some other litigation that's occurred in that case that the court's made a decision further down the road, whether it be a year, whether it be 2 years, and once they've made that decision, that now causes us to have to reevaluate the case. Another reason we could look at those things. Again, that evidentiary, those types of issues are small. If you wanted percentages, I can tell you about the counts, but that doesn't translate to cases, and I'm trying to keep percentages similar for you all. Now, the second category is what I call discretionary. Discretionary is where the prosecutor has decided to do something else other than move forward.
That can be because it's essentially a civil matter. It can be that the defendants pled in another case. It can be that counts are consolidated. Sometimes if we have someone that has committed multiple thefts, let's say they've committed thefts at Fred Meyer and they get released and they commit more thefts at Fred Meyer, instead of having them convicted in two different cases, we'll do what's called a consolidation and we'll ask the court to consolidate them. Well, sometimes those show up as dismissals because the paperwork for the consolidation didn't work exactly the way that it should. There can be times when someone is deported or extradited. There can be a pretrial diversion program they've completed. They can do something else. If it's somebody on felony probation, another type of plea negotiation can be, I have somebody that's on felony probation for a vehicle theft. They go out and they commit a drug offense. And in the felony PTR, or the petition to revoke probation, we decide there's sufficient time hanging over their head, there's an appropriate sanction that we can impose upon them, and we can dismiss the new case, extend probation, get them into treatment, do something that still addresses the core sentencing goals, but we don't need to give them a new conviction. I can't tell you how frequently that occurs. I can only tell you that that's another possibility of how things can work. Those are all discretionary reasons, most of which I consider to be part of plea negotiations. The final category is that there is some other legal issue. And legal issues can include that a defendant is deceased, a defendant is found to be incompetent, there can be a problem with Rule 45, there could be that it's transferred to another agency, whether it's to a municipality or to the federal government. So there are those types of things. And again, that's a very small category. I'd say that's the smallest of the three categories. But those are all the different reasons that cases can be dismissed. I would also tell you that the dismissal rates, which Ms. Mead talks about for 2011, when I look at those, there are two numbers that immediately jump out at me. One of them, I'm looking on the third line down, is 224 for the case not being filed. We don't consider that a dismissal from our perspective. We don't count it as such.
And let me just jump in, and I think that's an important point because that would be an instance, and I could be wrong, but that would be an instance where, in essence, the police have arrested somebody, and then the DA's office doesn't file a charge.
That's correct.
Okay. And so that's barely the creation of a case, and it's extinguished so quickly that there's as little impact on a defendant as you can sort of impose, short of not arresting him.
Agreed. And what I would tell you is that if you go back and you look at the numbers, you see that there are 224 of those in 2011. You go back to the time to disposition, and you see there's such that large percentage that's dealt with in the first 4 months, the first 120 days. So that's going to be incorporated within those. That's not all of them, but that's some of them. And then there's another chart here where I don't think those are included on. So those numbers are included on. Okay, I'm just confirming that my understanding of how they've done their numbers is correct. The second number that jumps out at me, gentlemen, is I look at the third line from the bottom, 96, which is dismissed, delay, and Superior Court transfer, or Criminal Rule 5E. I don't know how many of you are lawyers. I know.
Two out of three.
All right. So what happens is there's a criminal rule called Criminal Rule 5 that says when you are charged with a felony offense, the state has 10 days if you're in custody, 20 days if you're out of custody, to take the case to grand jury. If the case is not taken to grand jury, it is not transferred from district court into superior court, and you cannot go forward. That grand jury is essentially a screening process to decide whether or not there is sufficient evidence for the case to move forward as a felony.
Just
part of our Constitution.
Is that a dismissal with prejudice or without?
It's without prejudice, and that's the point I'm getting ready to make, okay. Chairman.
Some of those will come circled back in.
Exactly. The 96 that are represented there suggest to the court system that in 96 cases, a case did what we call Rule 5. It got dismissed because it wasn't indicted in a timely fashion. However, I believe that at least approximately half of those we go on to indict at a later time.
Once
so
built a stronger case.
While it's counted as a dismissal,
it's not
a case that's ultimately dismissed. It's a case we're able to go back to and recharge and carry forward. So I'm not taking issue with the court system's numbers. I'm only trying to explain why that wouldn't show up as one of our dismissals.
The context. Very helpful. And I'll need you to wrap up because we're running short of time and we have one more thing we want to get to.
Where I ultimately get to and what I want you to know is that when we look at our numbers, and they are slightly different than the court systems, the dismissal rate for felonies is 14.5%. 14.5%. And that includes all the plea negotiations that I was talking about a moment ago. So there are variances between our numbers, and the only thing that I would tell you about that is I would reference you back to the comments that Acting Attorney General Richard Sabodny made to you all about the appropriateness of trying to have one case management system or having numbers that are consistent. That solution, long-term solution, is the sort of thing that will help explain some of the number of variations that you see in front of you today.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Let's turn now to the other question, which was general time to disposition, irrespective of dismissals, but how long does it take to get a case to trial or disposition in felony court? Ms. Mead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I do actually have a few comments on Mr. Skidmore's presentation,
please.
But I could save those and talk to an agent.
We've got about, I don't want to abuse, the committee's got other places they ought to go and so forth, so we've got a few minutes. You got to run. Okay.
So the first thing I'll do is
we'll just listen.
Positions.
Okay.
It sounds like the other one will be less important, or I
sure.
can straighten out some of those things later. But the chart that I think is most instructive is the landscape one, the sideways one, that across the top has the different degrees of offenses. And
right. That's a purple banner. Right.
You got the nice colored version.
Oh, very good.
I'm looking at that one.
It should say murder, unclassified felony, unclassified felony, class A across the top, and then the days to disposition across the down the left
mm-hmm.
column.
Mm-hmm.
And let me just highlight the two or three points out of this one. Really, the main one is a little bit varied, but about two-thirds of the way down, you can see the mean for the different types of felonies, how many days it took from filing mm-hmm. to disposition, whether that is the sentence or the dismissal or the acquittal, and you can see those numbers under the mean, and then for all felonies, our mean is 216 days. So that is just about 7 months, which might, you know, some of these numbers might help inform your thinking about the what's been called felony delay, but we call it time to disposition for felonies. So 216 is the average time for a felony. And another, what I think is a fairly important number to look at, is along the right-hand column, the cumulative percentages. So for all these different types of felonies, you can see if you skip down to, for example, the third one, 89.4% all the way across, you can see that within 6 months to a year, 181 to 365 days, almost 90% of all felonies are completely over, completely. So that's a statistic that might be meaningful to you as you think about the time
very
these
meaningful.
Cases are.
I really appreciate that. Yes, thank
you. Okay. And the other kind of third major global thing I'd like to point out about this chart is that, as one might expect, the cases that are more serious, the offenses that are more serious, are the ones that are taking a longer period of time to dispose. And I'm sure Mr. Skidmore can expand upon the fact that when you have, for example, something in the murder category or unclassified felonies, for example, a sexual assault, you might have the crime lab involved, you might have DNA experts involved, and the you know consequences are so much more grave that the parties tend to take longer to prepare their prosecution and their defenses of those cases. So in that chart,
Remind me what just while we're looking at. Remind me what felony conversion is.
Sorry, that is nobody knows what that
means. I love it. I asked the question to subsidy experts. I feel.
No, I
thank
asked
you.
As well. I asked our statistics
right,
person
right,
as well
right.
because I didn't know conversion was a felon. I thought it was theft. Anyhow, it is. You can cross that column out. Frankly,
okay.
Those are our cases that. That were disposed, but before the conversion, which is our court name, to court view. So really, we don't have
uh-oh.
The detailed information about those cases in those categories as to what exactly they were. So that's a non-column, really. All those would be distributed somewhere else on the chart. So I'm sorry to say that was misleading. So again, as you look at the degree of offense and the mean, the average amount of time it takes, you can see about, again, halfway down, murder unclassified felony, the mean is 550 days, or about 18 months. So even for a murder, our average is 18 months. And as you would hope, as you descend that chart towards less serious offenses, the time is getting a lot shorter, as, again, you would expect, because for example, a Class C felony, which is a felony DUI and some drug offenses and theft, would take less time to prepare and prosecute and finish than some of the more serious offenses. So that is a global, and again, I'd be happy to talk with your staff or anyone about every detail on these.
I'm going to have to let the committee go and let the folks who are keeping the wheels turning go. But thank you very much. Excellent chart, excellent information. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore, for being here. It's really helpful to have these things and discussions. I appreciate it. And so, unless there's anything else to come before the committee, we're adjourned.